Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of Allergy Talk, a roundup of the latest in the field of allergy and immunology from the American College of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. Well, once again, we have more articles from Allergy Watch, a bi-monthly publication which provides research summaries to college members from the major journals of allergy and immunology. And for those listening to the audio version, we do have the video version as well on YouTube. So please check out the YouTube channel, youtube.com/allergists. And don't forget, whether you're doing the audio or the video version, we do have CME credit. You just head over to education.acai.org/allergytalk. And we can continue the conversation on Doc Matter. So please check out Doc Matter and talk about the articles we discussed today. Well, hello again. My name is Jerry Lee. I'm an allergist immunologist at Emory University, an associate professor, and an assistant editor of Allergy Watch. And today, once again, I'm joined by the editor-in-chief of Allergy Watch, associate professor, and section chief at Oregon Health and Science University, Dr. Shyam Joshi. Shyam, welcome back to Allergy Talk.
Thank you so much for having me again. Look forward to a great discussion.
And once again, in the third chair, we are so blessed to see Dr. Sarah Spreed, a staff allergist immunologist at AT Augusta Military Medical Center, associate program director of the Allergy Immunology Fellowship at Walter Reed, an associate professor of pediatrics at Uniformed Services University, and assistant editor of Allergy Watch. Sarah, welcome back to the podcast or vodcast.
Thanks, Jerry. Happy to be here.
Let's talk about allergies. So, Sarah, I think you are going to bring up a wonderful study that further encourages us to offer desensitization to help our young ones with allergic asthma. So tell us about this.
Yeah, thanks, Jerry. So sublingual immunotherapy for house dust mite is an area of interest for me. I want to bring more options to our families who have school-aged children or may live farther away from the academic medical centers. And I chose an original article published in the Journal of Allergy in December 2025 entitled SQ House Dust Mite Sublingual Immunotherapy Tablet in Children with Allergic Asthma. And this is by Roberts and colleagues, and I reviewed it for Allergy Watch. This was a multi-region phase 3 trial designed to assess the safety and efficacy in children age 5 to 17 with allergic asthma, and importantly, a recent history of asthma exacerbations despite treatment with a low or a medium dose inhaled corticosteroid with or without long-acting beta agonist. Now, it's really important to highlight, we really don't have a lot of data with the use of house dust mite sublingual immunotablets in this patient population. So we really don't have it for kids with allergic asthma. And so the intervention group was treated with 12 SQ house dust mite sublingual immunotherapy tablet for a total of 24 to 36 months. And the primary outcome they were looking at was annualized rate of asthma exacerbation. And a total of 533 subjects were randomized. Of those, 486 completed the trial. And it's noteworthy that the compliance was very high for both placebo and treatment groups. It was over 90% for both. Now, while the rate ratio of the annualized asthma exacerbations favored the treatment group at 0.89, the difference was not statistically different compared to the placebo. So in this case, superiority was not established. And of note, it was very well tolerated therapy. The most common treatment-related adverse events, not surprising, were oral itching, throat irritation, and upper abdominal pain. And this was really noted in the first week of treatment, and it tended to resolve after that. And there were no cases of EOE described in the treatment group, which is also noteworthy. Very few patients discontinued because of treatment-related adverse events also, so fewer than 2% of the subjects. And the biomarkers, specific IgE, IgEBF, and IgG4 levels all changed in the treatment group, consistent with immunomodulation. Now, I will point out that the enrollment for this study was discontinued early, and that was because of COVID-19 pandemic. And that's really important because this was a well-designed multi-region study and across the board, so treatment and placebo groups, they frankly saw fewer asthma exacerbations in everyone over the course of this trial. And that's important to highlight because we as humans were behaving very differently with social distancing. We weren't seeing as many viral infections, which probably had something to do with the overall decrease in asthma exacerbations across the board. And so I would love to see this trial done again post-pandemic to see if there was a superiority may have been established under different circumstances.
That's a tough break. It's a tough break for the authors, unfortunately. Do you, with the data that we have with the study, is this changing anything in your practice right now? And do you feel like there is a possibility that we will see dust mite tablets approved for this age group and for this indication?
I certainly hope so. I think what I take away from this study is that it's safe to use in this group. They did not see any of the treatment group suffer from a severe asthma exacerbation related to treatment. Because we get a little more nervous, and I know on our prior auth, we have to click that patient has controlled asthma, right? Because we don't want to induce an allergic asthma exacerbation from the therapy itself. So that's one of my takeaways, is more that it's safe to use in this group. And I would love to see a bit more efficacy data, I think, for this particular target population.
So first of all, I think that this absolutely supports what our general recommendation is and the NIAID guidelines, right? The 2020 guidelines, which suggests that we should intervene on dust mite with immunotherapy as an adjunctive treatment. And what's the problem? Well, subcutaneous immunotherapy is an access problem for a lot of our patients. And so sublingual immunotherapy absolutely is within reach. And what the comment I was about to make was, is that, Sarah, you choosing this article, we're anointing you the new Stan Feynman of this podcast, because he absolutely is a huge believer on immunotherapy. And I'm glad that we're continuing to talk about this. It is one of the few
treatments. I will accept the mantle, Jerry.
Exactly. He's going to be very happy that we are still talking about immunotherapy, because essentially, we still have one of the few treatments that's trying to control other than keep people on medicine forever, right? We're trying to reduce the allergen, and we're actually trying to reduce medication use, right? Like, there's very few treatments we're actually trying to get people off medicine, or at least reduce it as much as possible. So yes, I think it is unfortunate we have to unfortunately expose children to viral infections to prove something works. Like, no one wants that. But again, once we get very strong data, I think we're going to be able to convince people that, yes, we have to think about allergy in any child with asthma, and we have to go after it, not including environmental control, but consider desensitization. No caregiver should not at least be offered desensitization as a choice for their child, so they have a way to comprehensively treat their patients. I hope I didn't take your thunder, Sean, but like, did you want to add anything to
spot
that?
Spot on. No, I was just saying that was the study specifically looking at the first year, or were they planning on looking at longer than that?
It was designed for the 24 to 30 month interval, and they just had to stop screening enrolling because of the pandemic. Yeah. So it was underpowered.
Yeah. And so it's the same thing we see with the sublingual GRAS, right? It just takes longer. And I'm wondering if we were able to follow these patients longer, what is the 5-year outcome? What is the 10-year outcome? That's really, I think, would be what would sell this for a lot of patients, to understand that, hey, this isn't just about the next year. This isn't just about the next 2 years. This is about your entire childhood.
That's a great point.
Yeah, well said. And so again, I think I'm going to look forward to that follow-up, because I think they definitely have something here. And again, I would love to make sure we can overcome the access issues, because there's not a lot of allergists, right? But there's plenty of ways that through sublingual immunotherapy, we can improve the accessibility of desensitization as a treatment. So I want to talk about asthma in schools. And this was a study that was reviewed by Samantha Knox. So this was published in Pediatrics. This is entitled Stock Inhalers in Chicago Public Schools Using the ReAIM Framework to Assess Impact. And as you can imagine, this was done in Chicago. So stock epinephrine, let's start with stock epinephrine, because stock epinephrine is a legislative national legislation that allows that to be provided in all schools, all 50 states. But stock inhalers, which is the title of this article, is actually only in 25 states and the District of Columbia. So actually, we have like universal authority for schools to have an EpiPen, but albuterol actually is half the states. And so really, you have to think about, well, what is the evidence behind this intervention? And can we build a base to convince legislation on a national scale, or at least more states to adopt this therapy? And so, as you can imagine, this means that you have a rescue inhaler like albuterol or levobuterol that is not assigned to a specific child. You don't have to have a prescription that the child brings in, but it is available for anyone who needs treatment during the school day. And you can imagine this has a particular benefit for those who are having access to either the diagnosis of asthma or obtaining an inhaler that is unexpired due to access issues with either an asthma specialist or a pediatrician. And you can imagine that this is further magnified in a public school environment. So in the Chicago public schools, they have a population of 330,000 students, which identify as 46% Hispanic Latinx and 36% Black, with a significant number who may have asthma but don't have potentially the diagnosis or don't have regular follow-up to have an up-to-date inhaler or asthma action plan. And so this was a pilot project where they actually got funding from the state to implement a stock inhaler program starting at a pilot of 4 schools, but eventually expanded to over 100,000 children in the Chicago public school system to see what are the outcomes that can occur when you provide this therapy to these children in a public school environment who, again, may have these barriers. And so this occurred from 2023 to 2024, and they were given a protocol where through multiple educational sessions, they trained nurses to recognize the symptoms of either mild to moderate respiratory distress. This would be breathing or hard or fast, trouble talking or walking, and gray lips or breath. So those severe symptoms, they got 8 puffs of inhaler, and just more mild symptoms like just wheezing or shortness of breath, tightness of the chest, they get 4 puffs. And they were allowed to repeat it. They were trained. They were all given spacers as well. And the parents, they were allowed to opt out. But certainly if they did not opt out, they were almost all of them gave consent to give an inhaler, and they were mandated to be informed that they received the treatment after the fact. And so this intervention that started in a small number of schools and again eventually went to over 100,000 children found that, again, multiple patients did require the inhaler. They had approximately 15 stock inhaler events from the pilot and then 109 from the ramp-up school. So that's a total of 124 events where they had to use the stock albuterol. And only 71% of those children actually had the asthma diagnosis. So there were some undiagnosed children who received the inhaler. And very interestingly, only a third actually had an asthma action plan, right? And so really you could see that this population were identifying individuals who did not have the tools or access to the medication. And so when we look at the outcomes of this, what they found was when they applied this intervention, they were able to have about 2/3 of the individuals go about the class, about 69.2%. Now, 23% did have to leave the school with a caregiver, and unfortunately, 7.5% have to leave via EMS. But overall, when they interviewed the nursing staff, Again, this is a little subjective, but about 49.2 students probably would have had to go home if they did not have the stock albuterol available, right? So again, we are trying to keep children in school, and they estimate, again, this is subjective, but they estimate maybe 31% of the children probably would have had to leave by EMS if they did not have stock albuterol inhalers, albuterol available, right? So overall, this is like 3/4 of the students probably had an improvement of the potential outcome with this inhaler available. So this proof of concept in this particular group shows that we have a large number of children who either do not have the diagnosis of asthma or do not have an asthma action plan. And if we allow a stock albuterol be available during these events with a well-trained staff, we can not only prevent missed days of school, escalation to EMS, but also just making sure that we are trying to address some of the access problems we have with certain vulnerable populations with asthma. Now, again, there's still barriers that exist. This was a funded program from the state. Even if you have legislation that allows you to carry stock epinephrine, the school still needs a physician to provide the prescription, the standing order, and they have to buy the thing, right? So again, I mean, albuterol is not expensive, but getting the expense of the inhaler, the spacer, to train the staff, writing legislation, even if it's present, doesn't fully address all the issues. But again, this proof of concept shows that allergists, immunologists, pulmonologists, and other pediatricians can take a role in implementing a very impactful quality improvement project. Essentially, this was implementation science to really make significant impacts in patients with asthma. So I'd love to see more studies like this that support the funding of other outlays like this.
I'm so glad you reviewed this, Jerry. This actually prompted me to go and look and see. And yes, in fact, Virginia authorizes stock albuterol at schools, but it was really hard to find any data to determine how many schools are actually taking advantage of this in my state. And I don't know that that data exists. One comment I had for the paper, they did mention that 61% of nurses followed the protocol. And I wasn't sure, why wasn't it more? And it, did that go towards the training, or were things were they not recognizing the need for it, or was there no protocol for the child?
Yeah, there was some misclassification, obviously. Some of the incidents probably would have been mild to moderate versus severe. So again, 22 incidents got fewer puffs than recommended. I think those are some of the issues where maybe with better training, they'd be able to know who is the, again, mild to moderate versus the severe.
Sure.
These training things are hard too, because they're obviously at the beginning of the school year, they're getting trained for a lot of different things. And this was really evaluating one training session and seeing kind of how the impact was. If this is something that the nurses and the teachers see year after year, I would anticipate that the compliance would go up year two, year three, beyond.
Yeah, I think obviously when you're doing implementation science, I would imagine it's a quality improvement framework, right? You identify how your initial intervention worked and you'll modify it. And so I would expect with continued funding, because obviously they have this beautiful impact and measurable outcomes, that again, my expectation is that they absolutely should try to expand this as much as possible and hopefully use this as a model for other schools. And again, in a very deliberate fashion, this is not that they threw albuterol at people. There was multiple meetings of nursing education, thoughtful consent, and of course, obviously training that made this so successful in this population. All right. Well, I think those are some really interesting articles on children, but now let's talk about basic science. And again, Sham, I'm so glad you chose this article, because I think we always think about, you know, how to control pruritus and the mechanism of itch and atopic dermatitis. And I reviewed this article in JCI, but I would love for you to tell me about it. And again, for those of you who listened to the previous episode, we sort of gave you a teaser. So what did you have for us about itching?
Yes, thank you. So the article I'm going to talk about is called Type 2 Cytokines Pleiotropically Modulate Sensory Nerve Architecture and Neuroimmune Interactions to Mediate Itch. I know for me, usually if I'm flipping through a journal and I see this title, I'm going to probably keep going. But Jerry chose this article, and I think it was a great choice because there are some really interesting features that we're going to chat about. This is by Ja et al. And Jackie. And again, this was sponsored by Sanofi and Regeneron. This is a basic and translational science paper. So starting with itch, we know itch is multifactorial. And trained in allergy and immunology, we always think of the inflammation side of things. We think of the immune cells that are playing a role in itch, but itch is so much more than that. It's really a complex crosstalk between immune cells, keratinocytes, neuronal circuits. And previous studies have really looked at how these type 2 cytokines, we're mainly talking about IL-4, IL-13, and IL-31 today, can lead to neuron synthesis and multiple type 2 conditions like atopic dermatitis, like chronic urticaria. And we also know that there's been some in vitro studies that have shown that eosinophils that are positioned near neurons can lead to neurite branching. So neurite is just a fancy term for saying anything that's branching out from the neuronal cell body. So it includes axons, includes dendrites. And this has been shown to occur in mouse dorsal root ganglion sensory neurons. But the exact role of what IL-4 and IL-13 do compared to IL-31 in these situations remains unknown. Here at OHSU, we have actually, there's quite a few labs that are working on the interaction between eosinophils and the neuronal system in asthma and in atopic derm. So this is something near and dear to my heart. So in this study, what they did is they took human and mouse dorsal root ganglion neuron cultures, and they looked at their neurite outgrowths and transcriptomics for those specific neurons. They also took a mouse ear, pinnae, and they processed it for histological transcriptomics and proteomics analysis as a second part of this study. And it was actually, I'm narrowing this down. This was a very large, intense study, but it was some really interesting things came from it. So when you look at these cultures, so these are the human cultures, they treated them with IL-4 and IL-13, and they found right off the bat that there were 464 genes that were differently expressed in these neurons. 333 were upregulated, 131 were downregulated. Great. What does that actually mean? So some of these genes are known to modulate neuroinflammation, neuronal development, neuronal function, like SEMA4, TACR1, et cetera, et cetera. So, okay, already off the bat, we know IL-4, IL-13 do something to the genes that would potentially lead to neuronal changes. They also showed that there was neuronal growth. So all IL-4, IL-13, and IL-31 independently increased neurite outgrowth, so axons, dendrites. Okay, interesting. But IL-4 and IL-13 specifically did this much more robustly than IL-31 did. And IL-13, not IL-4, led to an increase in sensory neuronal branching. And we know that sensory neuronal branching increases neuron action and can increase itch as well. So IL-13 seems to be a little bit more important in how the neural system changes when exposed. Then they took the mouse ears, and they administered IL-4, IL-13, IL-31, and they found that all of them increased the intraepidermal nerve fiber density. Again, more nerve fibers there can increase the itch. IL-4 and IL-13, but not IL-31, increased epidermal thickness, mast cell recruitment, eosinophilic recruitment. So we're showing both things. We know that happens. We know that the immune side's happening, but we're also showing that the neuronal side is happening. And then finally, they also injected live mice with IL-4, IL-13, IL-31, and they looked at their behavior. And they found that IL-13, I think this is the most interesting part of this whole article, that IL-13 and IL-31 elicited scratching behavior, but IL-4 by itself did not. And that kind of goes to the point where we have anti-IL-13s for atopic dermatitis, which are very effective and probably are doing the heavy lifting here. And so the authors concluded that IL-13 and IL-31 are direct acute pruritogens. So they directly induce pruritus. When IL-4 and IL-13 are co-administered, then the itch that was created by IL-13 gets enhanced. You get a synergistic effect. And so the thought process, again, is that IL-4 is probably bringing in some of these immune cells. IL-13 is causing this direct itch. And when you combine those two, that's what's kind of enhancing the itch. So I don't know. I thought it was a very interesting article. I think it really brings to life Jerry's question from last podcast, which was asked, if we can combine IL-13 and TSLP, are we going to get additional benefit? How does that actually work if TSLP is an alarm in? It's upstream. Why would adding anti-IL-13 further benefit that? And I think this is absolutely one of the mechanisms. We know that this takes place in asthma. We obviously know it takes place in atopic dermatitis, that combination could make a difference in terms of different mechanisms of actions improving patient symptoms.
Fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, IL-31 gets all the press, but I think you flip it around, IL-13, yeah, it's no slouch out either. I think I thought this was also very interesting. We clearly have always wondered, other independent of just reducing inflammation, what could be the potential mechanism of why dupilumab is so effective for atopic dermatitis? And it's directly acting on itch, right? Yeah. And I thought that was so interesting. I'm so glad you reviewed this article.
Yeah, one other thing
that makes sense. You know,
one other thing I found interesting is when you look at the dupilumab data for chronic urticaria, we've shown that it doesn't work as quickly as omalizumab or Remi. But when you break it down, the itch improvement is actually on par with the rest of them very quickly. It's the urticarial side of things that actually takes longer to improve. And so again, I think that's playing, some of this anti-IL-13 is going to be playing a role in that itch component of CSU in addition to atopic derm.
And I love that it gives us insight on this neuroimmune crosstalk that you mentioned, right? Because then also dupilumab for prurigo nodularis. Now it starts to make a little more sense. We're addressing that itch and that itch scratch cycle that apparently is just getting increasingly more complex as we dig into it.
Yeah. So the neuroimmunology research that we continue to learn about how well our immune system interfaces with the neuroreflex causing all sorts of stuff, bronchospasm, rhinitis, all of these we think are neurologically mediated. Now, itch through these cytokines, it just adds to that story. So I think I'm really glad you brought this forward. That's why I chose this article. I always like to torture myself by reading like Science and Nature just to learn what's out there to the best of my ability. I'm no genius about anything. But that's where we learn about how fascinating this works. That's the satisfaction we get with allergy immunology as a field, just looking underneath the hood and discovering why things happen. And then again, how we learn how the therapeutics treat the disease mechanistically. So I really loved the discussion today. If you've had thoughts on any of the articles we discussed today, please send us your feedback. That email is algetalk1word@acaai.org, or you could drop a comment in our YouTube channel. And of course, if you want to listen to any of the other podcasts, please, again, go to our YouTube site. Please go to our podcast channel. And of course, don't forget about CME. That's education.acaai.org/allergytalk. Or to read all the articles we didn't have time to go over. That's college.acaai.org/publications/allergywatch. Well, I enjoy this very much. I learn something every day. Sarah, Sham, thank you so much for contributing, and I'll see you next time.
Thanks, Jerry. This was fun.
Thank you.
The ACAAI is presenting this podcast for educational purposes only. It is not medical advice or intended to replace the judgment of a licensed physician. The college is not responsible for any claims related to the procedures, professionals, or products or methods discussed in the podcast, and it does not approve or endorse any products, professional services, or methods that might be referenced.